Southern California Chinese American Oral History Project, jointly sponsored by the UCLA, Asian American Studies Center, and the Chinese Historical Society of Southern California. This is the duplicate tape of Mrs. Lily Lam Chen's interview, original tape 1.
From a 90-minute tape to a 60-minute tape.
Good morning. Whatever you want. Okay. How many of you are Cantonese? How many of you are
English?
I think English would be fine for the beginning if I get stuck on top.
But if you have names or something that you prefer.
Yeah, okay. They got to know.
Guangdong
Ma, Mandarin, Mao, and
in the middle, we could go and do some Guangdong Ma just to see how it works out.
Yeah, anything.
Right?
Mandarin, okay,
yeah.
If you can tolerate that.
Okay.
How about? Either, okay? Anything you want to, just to get through and get what you want from the little.
So maybe you could start from the beginning and tell us about, how long your family has been in the United States and, you know, where in China they came from. And so.
I don't think I did. No, I didn't bring them up. My family is really a composite part of American and Chinese life. We talk about my family, meaning my own husband and my family, or my father.
Well, let's start with your parents first.
All right. My father was born in America, but my grandfather came from China. Per usual, they came as merchants, and my father was a merchant in Ukiah and San Francisco. For the major part of their life. I mean, my father's father, my grandfolk. Did I say my grandfolk?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I have to jump back another generation. But anyway, they came over by boat. They didn't have to skip immigration in order to get into the country. And for years, my grandfolk were with the area where they have gold mining and business, you know, up north in Ukiah area. And then later on, to make the long story shorter, I'll give you a brief resume that they moved down to San Francisco. San Francisco, where my father was born. My father was the only son of three, of a family of three daughters, at least three or four daughters. One perished early. But anyway, my father was taught by tutor Chinese, a few years of Chinese language, and he went to the religious classes, not school, in San Francisco, and Salvation Army and such places where they provide English lesson and learn his English. So he was very able and very studious and industrious, and I say a little brilliant, and became very, very prominent in leadership, especially with the Chinese American Citizens Alliance and the Chinese Times, the two still remaining organizations that he founded with a few of his good friends. My mother was born in San Jose, I imagine. I was told she died at the age of 45, but she was a very good mother and gave birth to 7 children. And I'm the number 3 in the family. And Emma, my youngest sister, who is now attorney in San Francisco, is number 5. All of us try to do our best to follow the footsteps of my father. But anyway, my daddy's whole life and philosophy was basically to relieve the Chinese of being embarrassed in our life. And so he started when he was 18 years old, tried to learn English, and still with the old-fashioned queue. You know, they used to make them wear queue until he was married. Then they cut the long tail off from his hair. So he said to us that the Chinese are being belittled and embarrassed, and what can we do? So he exemplified himself by learning English and came out to do something like what you are all doing in a large scale. And so we grew up in a family where my mother was very religious, a Christian, a Presbyterian, and my father was not so technical about joining what church, but he has a very strong Chinese philosophy of life, Confucian study, and even the Buddha study. So he was a man that said that you choose a good religion for the children. So as a child, we were in every church. In the morning, we went to the Episcopalian church. In the afternoon, we went to a Presbyterian church. In the evening, we were in the Congregation church. And weekend, we were interdenomination church, you know. And there, I was in a choir with my sister. In other words, our environment was a trifle little more advanced and modernized than the regular Chinese family at that time. But we were very fortunate. My daddy realized the influence of Chinatown at that time may be sometimes negative. So he bought a home in the Mission District, way on a little small hill, where we had to live there all through the week. Weekend, we go to Chinatown. And at the end of the day, if we wanted to, we go to the Chinese language school, the Morning Bell Chinese School, I remember, the first co-educational Chinese school that allowed girls to enter. Used to be just for boys, Zhonghua, Huakao. And then later come the Hipwo Huakao, which was more enlightened by the interdenominational leaders. And they allow also co-education. So there, my girlhood was very rich. But then I watch what's going on around me, how unfortunate some of the young ladies and students of my time, they had to go home after work and they would have to live in the second floor mezzanine in a store, like for example, Sungwo Jia Fo Po, and they have to live upstairs. And they go home and the father and mother are very, very, I would say, conservative. You call old-fashioned in a nice way. And so my life is a little trifle easier during those days. But my father realized how fortunate we are. He kept on telling us that we must do something for the community. When we live in a community, the greater whole is more important than a single, you know, the smaller circle. So there we were imbibed with the idea that you have to give back to society what you gain. So as the years went by, I went to a Chinatown school for a couple of years. My mother went back to China. My father went back to China and took the last four children went back with her. And I was one of them that wouldn't stay behind to finish my schooling. My older sister and the second sister, Alice and Mabel, stayed in America. But following my mother and my father back to China, my father was trying to build something for the CACA, Navy Son of the Golden State at that time.
Do you know roughly when that was?
The 1917 or 18, I think.
I was reading the newspaper and
good for you. I was a little girl then, you know, and then I know that in coming back by steamship, it took almost a month, you know. And my mother had to tell her and take the last four in the family before my baby sister was born to be with my father. And also for her, it was either the first or second trip that she went back to. She was American born too, like all of us here, you know. And so while they were visiting China and sightseeing, my father was planning things for the CACA in a beautiful building on near Yanzhai Dai Gai. That's where I'm going to tell you the Lao family's father knows something about that medical school, you see. Instead of fooling around, you know, playing, I was very serious. So I had the tutoring and went to a smaller school and learned my Chinese for 20 more months. Of course, I have a basic training already in America. Now, see, this is hard for me to not jump from one thing to another. Oh. But anyway, for about 2 years, my parents were in Canton, China, and I was observing and looking at the horrible economic problems that they have around the facility where we have a beautiful building where we have two stores for ourselves, you know. My father had a first floor for his business, and we live in the upstairs penthouse layer. And I often look down from above and see what's going on, you know, the coolies, you know, selling things and all the peddlers and the rickshaw bearers and all those. So I guess that childhood, you know, impression gave me something, did something to my mind. And I always said that, gee, because we're fortunate, we see what we can do to alleviate the other people that are not so, you know, well provided for. Then while I was in China, I got a very good tutoring for 2 years, and then I also tutored my kid brothers for homework. The four, my two brothers and a sister, I think. Yes, that's before Victoria was born, the baby. But then after 2 years, we came home, and then we faced the Chinese community again.
How old were you when you came home?
I don't remember, about a teenager. I'll trace it back. It was either 11 or 13. Then in San Francisco, we still were supposed to get a flat on Clay Street between Powell and Stockton Street. It was a more advanced living, you know, than to living in a big house where everybody has a room in the channel of a hallway, you know. Everybody used the same kitchen. So my father was always a little bit more ahead, and then he was very modernized. So we had a flat on 914 Clay Street for a bit, and later on we went to a hotel and lived San Jun Guok on what you call street now, still there with another name. But then we bought a home. My father bought a home in Mission District, 29th and Mission at Peters Avenue, right opposite the St. Joseph Hospital. Now then we were more or less Americanized on one, you know, faith at one time during the day, and then in the evening we were shoved off to the Chinese Morning Bell School to study Chinese. And who was supposed to be the monitor? I was the monitor, and the older girl was married and the second daughter had to stay home. So I was lucky enough to be in between. So I went and get my Chinese, you know, refresher courses with the Chinese school. And then as the years go by, I went through girls' high school, one of the higher standard school, because I did make good in grade school, elementary school. And did I tell you that during that time, Chinese were not supposed to go to any Caucasian school. No Chinese are supposed to go outside of Chinatown. Everyone must finally go to the Oriental Chinese school Sacramento Street, Washington Street, opposite the M.E. Church. Plantingly. And my father got a little disgusted and said that, well, we're American citizens, we have Chinese skin, but we are paying just as much tax. So he took the courage, you know, lining all the children up and went to the Lincoln School on 4th Street near Santa Clara in San Francisco, and talked to the lady, Miss Watson. I remember her name, very nice woman, but she said the law is that we have no non-Caucasian students here. So we went there, and then practically railroaded us into the school. But then we, the Chinese, you know how, you all do the same thing. We all have excellent, great, you know, excellent, good, fair, and then whatever, so on. But after a month of schooling there, the principal was so, happy and so sorry that she said something to the effect that we're not allowed to enter. So the story went on that we went through four to eight years, depending when we were transferred. And with flying colors, my brother, all of them made good, you know, in their studies. So then I went to a girls' high school. My sister went to Lowell High, and all my other brothers went to the different choice. And I get through from college, get through from high school and went to California, major in education administration and minor in my economic studies, you know, social studies and so on. Then while I was able to admitted into California, my mother had a heart ailment, a case when today would be nothing. But in those days, it was supposed to be rest, quiet, you know. So I decided I'm going to get through in 3 years and get out of from college and do something and help my father with the expenses of doctors and, you know, care. So in 1929, August, just a few months before I finished my 3.5 years of college, matriculation, my mother died. And it shocked me to no end because she was the one to tell us that everybody that went to school will be blessed by her, and she would give a big party. In those days, they don't give parties to children. You give parties to the elders. My mother was the first lady that, you know, everybody's birthday or graduation. One of my brothers was graduating from junior high school, and my sister was from high school, and I was from college. And she had an idea. She said, I'm going to give a big party at the Mandarin nightclub, you know, which is supposed to be something at that time, down the hill on Grand Avenue. So she didn't live to do that for us. So the reason I mention all these things is I know that many of my student friends who have lots of money, father might be in business or a gambling business, they have chauffeur to go, take them to school, but they don't have the spiritual blessings that I have from my, you know, family. And maybe that's the reason why I'm very tolerant of the hardships and people's, you know, negative lives. So that's the way I was reared until, and then while in college, when I was in college, I sought a job at the inter-denomination Chinese people or Chinese school, which is still surviving, to teach the Chinese language. Those that are born and raised in America and had never had a chance to speak, even learn Chinese. So it was a gathering place for as a babysitting place and also Chinese culture promotion. Those schools were run by four or five denominations of the Chinese Protestant faith. And opposite us was the Catholic school, which has enough equipment and money to run its own. But all the denominations were the Protestant churches who had to get together to you know, make us consolidate their effort. So the school grew and grew, and I taught until I got married. And we only taught 18 hours a day after college. You know, I taught 18 hours a day, Saturday included. That's why 3 hours a day. And then you have to cope with these active and very robust students running around, don't want to stay in Chinese school. They didn't like it, but the parents shoved them there, you know, asked them to anyway be babysitted. And then once in a while, you have an Ethan Allen naughty boy, delinquent boy that come into the class and write on the blackboard, Pai Lum, Pai Lum. My name was Lum. I was Miss Lum, see. And then because he resented the parents putting him in a class where the students were about 2 or 3 years younger than he, and he had been a naughty boy, you know. But all those things are a good experience for me. It was very difficult, challenging, but that mellowed me down to be more tolerant. And so I got through training just before, after I graduated and got through, and I went to a business place to learn how to, the facts of life. I went to IMAT and Company, assisted a buyer because my mother died and I was very sick. I said, I don't want to go on because my mother is not here to see me, you know, as a teenager. So I went to IMAT and assisted a buyer for a couple of years before I got married. And then in the meantime, I was doing some research on postgraduate studies, you know, languages and things like that. I had always stood by my own. I'm a self-very independent person. I know how to work in the library, and I know how to interview people. And I'm always amongst the lawyers and people who are highly educated to learn from them. But anyway, that's my education in a nutshell when I was younger. So I went back to China with my husband, married, and in Peking, I further studied my Chinese culture, and I brushed up my fresh in my Mandarin, which I learned when I was a child. But I could only read and talk word by word. Well, there was no, you know, no intonation correct perfection. But when I went back there, for 3 months, I listened to my sister-in-law, who was living in the same house with me, order the servants and help around. And then I got the colloquial. And then 3 months later, I started bursting off. I almost shocked her to pieces because she said, she expected to be my interpreter until for many years. But in 3 months, I was able to order the same servant that we used in common to help me. And then as the years go by, my husband was teaching at the Harvard of China, Peking National, where I met Dr. Hu Shiji, the famous philosopher, and many of these scholars. And then we have a lot of contact with them. And there I also had a lot of experience with good, highly cultural people. And I observed their manners and then the culture, the tradition of Peking, which made me very happy. The outside of Peking is very dusty, because the Gobi Desert blow a lot of dusty, you know, gray particles into your house. And the windows had to be made so that it's windproof, dustproof rather. But it's a very interesting building. You always have a patio in the middle, and then you have four sections where you divide your home into a living room, guest room, and the kitchen and help area and so on and so on. I had a very beautiful life there for half a decade with my kid brother going to Yinjing and Tsinghua at the same time. Weekend we get together. And Arthur Lum, he used to be a champion in Chinatown playing tennis. You know, maybe some of the old friends of his can't remember him. But at any rate, it was a very rich life in Peking. The outside is not a bit like the Western world. The place is it's very simple outside. The streets are hutong. Hutong is a dusty alley. And you can take a rickshaw out of your prams into the street that it's going to be dusty all the way until you get to your destination. But the beauty of Peking is that it's a cultural center for all our Chinese heritage. And at the same time, they were so used to having emperors, you know, that ruled that area all through. And the people are very obedient. And if you're a housewife, you don't have the hectic time that you have in Hong Kong and Shanghai, where the commercial and metro part of the life is, they're always challenging the host or the mistress of the family. So it was a very beautiful life. We had from 3 to 7 servants graduating as the family grew. My two daughters were born in Peking. They are Pekingese, they call her. The older daughter, who's a medical doctor in Boston now, Betty, she was born in Peking a year after I married, and then came the other one 2.5 years later, Adora, who's now investment counselor with the Encino company. But she was firstly with the E.F. Hutton. The two sisters, they both work different, you know, one is in the commercial world, the other is in the medical or cultural world. That's all I have, and five grandchildren, which I keep on repeating that I have. So my family is not too big, but my life has been very interesting. Challenging, yes, very challenging. Eventful, yes, most eventful. Every move I make, there is something that I have to cope with, but they're all interesting things that give the world a little betterment, see. So for that reason, I think I'm a lucky woman, and I'm past 70 today, you know. I'm not a young lady like you folk are. Whatever experience I had, well, I should be able to leave a little good ones behind for you folks to, you know, to remember anyway. And so where am I now? I have gone as far as to Peking.
Peking
for 5 years. Now Peking is in Peking in China.
No, where?
Peking in the year of 1933 to the Second World War, 37, end of 37. But we were uncertain that the war was going to be a more permanent situation. We thought it was going to be one of these incidents that they call it, and they're going to talk peace. But the Japanese were strong, so we didn't do very much. And the only refuge I could find is to come back here. I was in Shanghai for a month. My money was running short. And then I went back, when I say I, my family and I. And then we went to Canton. My sister was there. It was in a safe place. Then we went back to Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, by the way, when we refugee there, Anna May Wong's sister, Lulu, anybody knew her? Know her? She is the one that said, Lily, you stay here. I give you one room to stop over until I find an apartment or something when you're a refugee down there. So we have 5 beds along with my children, my babies, and my amas and all that. So we lingered there and amongst almost a quarter of a year. Then there was no solution to this war. It's going to become larger. And so my father was looking high and low for me. I never wrote to him that I have refugee from Peking to Hong Kong. So finally, it dawned upon me that I didn't notify Daddy, and they were, you know, wiring to all the consulate all over Hong Kong, and not Hong Kong, Peking, to locate us. So finally, after they located us, everybody chipped in and said that buy fares and buy a ship, transportation and passage, and come home. And then I negotiated until, you know, I have to fix everything up before I could prepare to get home. So in 1937, at the end of the year, I arrived home in Hong Kong, in San Francisco, for Christmas. And then my daughter was just barely 3 years old when she landed, got on the boat. And I tell you one little story. See, according to regulation, if the child is more than 3 years old, you have to pay a quarter. under 3 years old, you don't have to pay. So instead of having a Christmas party, I mean a birthday party for her, you know, when we bought the ticket, she was under. Mm-hmm. I want to save a quarter of that money. See how tight I was, you know. And then, but then we got home safely, and we had a very nice first class, what you call cabin. Accidentally, they didn't have enough cabin for my tourist money, so I got a first class cabin because I have to squeeze in a baby myself and another baby, see. So this is just a little, you know, a story to tell you what I went through, you know, to come home. After I came home,
you went
had
back
to
San Francisco
this time? Yeah, for San Francisco for a short while, for a few months. My sister Alice Y and Wingo Y, they took care of me for a bit, and then I rented an apartment across the street, and then I got three refugees with me from Peking, whose parents were governor of this and that, you know, big official people, and they were teenagers. They said, yeah, well, they won't need much attention. Bring them along. I said, okay. You know, I was so innocent that I brought them along, but I had a lot of problems afterwards when they were growing up, but that is not important. So in San Francisco we stayed, and finally Loyola, no not Loyola, Pomona hired my husband for a part-time lecture back to, you know, his first was for Chinese culture, that's his natural training, but his specialty was political science, law and government. Gradually, then we taught there for a few years, and then the Chinese Women's Club, I was working with Stanley's mother to other more modernized leaders to form like the first strong Chinese women's club to do things for the community and to the people of China in distress, and then later on for the American government on account of the war being, you know, enlarged.
That's down here, I guess.
In Los Angeles. Now I'm hopping from, you see, when you talk about something, it's not one straight line. So what would you, what is the last thing I do I should link up with?
Well, could you tell us about, you know, like, were the kinds of people who were in the club also?
Oh yes, that would be fine. Oh yeah, that might hit into the material. See, at that time, they already had a meeting or two to try to form the first Chinese women's club in order to perform some activities for the people of China, for like orphanage relief and comforting of the military and that, and so on and so forth. And meantime, and locally, the Chinese Zhonghua Weiguns, Chinese Consultative Benevolent Association, was also doing its share to raise money. Of course, naturally, war needs money. So they want to augment the strength. Nobody was able to cope with the people who were who were doing organization. It was hot like mad. 90-some degree, you have to sit in a piece of ice to cool off that day.
Just for
water? No, I think I have a little a water with you. What else? I'm going to tell you about the women's club. It's something that
Before you tell us about the women's club, maybe you could give us a little background, because see, so far you've been in San Francisco and everything. Now, you know, like how big was Chinatown in L.A. at that time? And
Chinatown. Okay, they say 5,000 only, including those that live around. Chinese were about 5,000 at that time.
It would also be nice when you're going through this to throw in dates once in a while. Mm-hmm. You did the
approximate.
It's very difficult for us to find out what year.
Okay. No charge. Okay, what else now? I'm glad to get the suggestion.
Your grandfather was here, must be in the 1870s. If your father was born here.
Yeah.
And so forth. So at that time,
sure.
The immigrants that came from China, were they mostly
Khoisan
people or Samya people?
Oh, mostly Samya. Mostly Khoisan, they're the king you know.
And they came over, and your grandfather's contemporary, they came over to work in the mines or the railroad?
Most of them worked as laundrymen and in the mines, and gambling. Mm-hmm. They have to do something to make a living. And the gambling was done by mostly the miners, you know, and some Chinese, you know, at the end of the day. That's their poker game. A modern poker game, the Mahjong party, they have there the same sort of likes and dislikes, you know.
Did money go back?
No, no, no. No, my folk stayed here until the end. See, you're talking,
I'm talking about the grandfather's days.
Yeah. You know, most of them did. If they save $500 or so, I'm going to glide this in later. You ask me.
Yeah, see, I have a lot of questions to fill in.
I'm trying to get my continuity.
Yeah, see, Helen, I have a lot of questions also like that I want to fill in and get.